session number 11363, Reel 2.
Mr. Withers, Reel 2. So what was it like in your Royal Navy training? Can you describe it a bit?
Well, it was just beginning of March, early March, 3rd of March when I went. And we did, as I say, 6 weeks. It was the usual square, what we used to call square batting, you know. Drill, you know, with a rifle. Marching up and down and all that. And learning to tie knots and general seamanship. Going out in the whaler and boat pulling, you know. Things like that.
How were you treated?
Very well, really. They were mostly the tutors, you know, the chaps who did learn to all these things. They were mostly, they'd served time. They'd done time serving, you know. They'd done their full stint in the Navy. And they came back on reserve. They were more or less retired, you know. You know, to us they were, anyway. But they were old, you know, they just wanted a quiet life, most of them. And they were very good, really. They treated us very well. You know, very considerate for the most part.
Do you think the training was adequate for what you had to do?
Well, it was, I suppose. It's the best they could do at the time. But what we did 6 weeks, as I say, this seamanship. And then we did a month's gunnery. That was at Pateli. And when we finished the month's gunnery, I was drafted up to Liverpool, HMS Wellesley, it was called. It was an old hospital. They did say it was the old Liverpool General Hospital, but I don't know whether that was true. But it was an old hospital, and they still got all the old laundry and everything intact in this place. We used to do our washing in the laundry, and they got all the gear there. It's a very old one, a Victorian building, you know. And we did a month's training there. We went down to Ainsdale, to the firing range. That's down on a bit towards Southport, you know, on there. That's the place we used to do the firing. There was an old wreck on the sands out on the estuary there, and we used to fire away at that for target practice. And they'd bring a blackbird skewer, used to tow a drogue, and they'd try and shoot the plane down, some of them. You'd think they would try to shoot. So it must have been a hair-raising job sitting towing these targets. But nobody, they all came unscathed, you know, they fired the drogue. But they weren't too bad at all, really. And we did a month there. And then, at the end of the month, you had exams. And, of course, it was lectures and all this business. And the hardest job, I think you've very likely been told this before, was in these lecture rooms, in the summer. This was summer then, you see, going into June. I was keeping awake, you know, with the old chap standing there in front, he was droning away, and he'd say, "You at the back." Everybody tried to get to the back so they could have a few winks without being caught. So one day, I can remember this because it's very vivid. I was nodding, you know, and he was lectured on depth charges. And on the firing mechanism of a depth charge. And he caught me just nodding. "Oh, now stand up," he said, "for the rest of the lecture." So he went babbling on, you know. And then he, like all lecturers do, stopped and says, "Ask questions." So he asked, the first question he asked, "It's something to do in the firing mechanism of a depth charge. It's regulated by an opening in the end. The wider that is, the quicker it fills with water. The shallower, you know, it goes off, the quicker it goes off." You know what I mean? the longer it takes to go down, the deeper it is when it explodes, something like that. I can't exactly, but it's something in that. And he asked this question about Buddhahood, and nobody looked for him, no. And he turned around to me, he said, I suppose you know. I said, well, matter of fact, I do. And I told him, yeah, you can sit down again. It's the only bit of the lecture I'd understood. It's a little bit, the one bit I'd been awake, wide awake, you know. But now it was all right. I like Liverpool. I like the Liverpudlians. Yeah, I like the Scousers. And I always have done. And I always will. I always think about,
Let's go on to your first ship, because that was the Empire Pintail. Can you tell me about that?
Yeah. Well, we finished at Wellesley, and two lists went up, one foreign draft, one home. So I was on foreign draft, and we moved down to London, and eventually we went by train from Euston up to Greenock. And we joined an American transport, troop ship, and went down to New York to pick up new ships. And we went sailing a convoy of four American troop ships, an American battleship, four destroyer escorts or destroyers, and a heavy cruiser, and they convoyed us across. We didn't know where we were going. And till the last day, the day we arrived, and it was foggy when we got in, we were in New York.
This was the summer of 1942, was it?
Yeah. It'd be about the beginning of July then, by the time we got to
you. And you never saw the enemy?
No. No went across, no trouble, no bother at all. 1942.
Who was on the... What kind of people were on the ship that you were on?
On the transport?
Yes.
They're all American crew. They brought GIs across, you see, and they were going back more or less empty to the States to pick up more GIs, you know, American troops.
Were all the passengers Dems, people like yourself?
No. There's about I think there were about 40 Dems, Jeff, and the others were RAF. I think there were only a few hundred, and exactly how many I don't know. But there were several hundred RAF. They were going for, training for pilots and whatever in the States. They trained a lot over there, as you know, during the war. So we landed in New York, and we were sent to a place called Flushing Barracks. It was a sort of overspill, I should think, from Brooklyn Navy Yard. We were there for about a week, and the notice went up on the board. Volunteers wanted for a ship for a 4 months voyage to the Middle East, returning to the States. So I run out of money, sort of thing. Money didn't go far. The bars and what, that's a bright light. This was a good place to be in New York, was in wartime.
Why?
Well, plenty of all the lights are lit, no rationing. And at that time, you see, uniforms were more of a novelty. You know, all the great war heroes we were seasoned warriors, so they thought. And you had great difficulty in buying your own beer, you know, in most of the pubs, well, the bars. And we were treated, you know, we all seemed to find a little niche somewhere and get your feet under the table. And there's unlimited food, no rationing, the lights, all the lights, no blackout. It was like heaven, you know. It was like landing in paradise to us. Well, I mean, the background I came from, I mean, it was especially... You know, I can. Well, do you want reminiscences of anybody else? We went in. I'll give you an example. The first day or two we were there, we went in a restaurant, cafe or whatever it was, and this one chap said, the waitress came up. She said, "What do you want?" He said, bring me the biggest plate you've got, big dinner plate, and I want it covered with fried eggs. And she did. They obliged him. And he sat there and scoffed a lot. Because he hadn't seen any eggs, so, you know.
How many?
I don't know how many there were, but it was a big dinner plate. And he sat there and scoffed a lot. But you get people like, in one instance, down in Times Square. You never got, if you went back to the barracks at 3 o'clock in the morning, they say, you're back early. It is usually a case of, the bars were open till 4. They closed at 4 o'clock till 6 for the cleaners to mop the floors. And you could go and get drunk before breakfast, if you wished. You could stay out. You would be out all night just boozing. You were never sober. It was a terrible life, it was. A very hard life.
So you didn't come across any hostility from the Americans?
No, no. You might get the odd... I met up with a girl over there, and they were very good. They're an Irish family, Kelly the name was. And they lived in Jersey City. And another chap, the chap I used to know, palled about with, he went out with her two sisters. And there was an Irish woman, she'd had too much to drink, Irish extraction, sat opposite to us, you know, other two seats, off, face each other and backs of buses. And she went, tore into him because he was a limey, you know, and the usual goddamn limey, and, you know, you don't know what a beer and all this. But that was the only time we ever had any, never had any hostility. We were treated.
What did the girls say to her?
They weren't there. We just left the girls and just gone back. And we met up with these girls in Times Square in a pub. They were with two Marines. Two American Marines, and there was three of us. We were with a chap who stopped us on the street and asked us in for a drink, and he got a wad like that, dollar
like
bills.
Like your fist.
And all the beer, till he keeled over, and the girls came over and asked, well, one of the Marines came over and asked if we'd join them, and because the girls wanted to hear English. They went in a bit of English accent, you know. And that's how it struck up from there. We used to go over to, they were very good to us. Matter of fact, they were really, and the mother and dad were the same. They'd been out. They were born in Ireland, the mother and dad, you know, Southern Ireland. But there was no hostility to us. They seemed like a mother to me, the mother was. You know, she's a motherly sort. She was, they're very good, yeah.
Now, I interrupted you with you talking about volunteering for the ship.
Oh, I'm sorry, I'll divert.
No, I divert.
You tell me if I, you know, go straight off. Well, they wanted volunteers, so I thought, well, we're running short of money, you know, with money didn't go nowhere. And so I volunteered. And we joined the ship. I forget exactly where it was in New York somewhere loading. And the first ship I'd ever been on, you know, a cargo ship. And it was all chaos, as it is with the old, you know. Everything was chaotic, all a jumble, you know, when they loaded up, there's deck hatch covers here stacked up on the side. And stuff, debris and dunnage and stuff all over the place. It's chaos, isn't it, when they load you. And it was all seemed, you know. Anyway, we loaded rails, steel rails for the railway lines, you know, railway lines. Tank tracks, spare tank tracks, flat cars and bogies for the railway cars. Myers Jamaica rum in box cases, Canadian Doors Black Horse beer, Canadian beer, loaded that sort of the part. Tin potatoes, soil inks, some recovery vehicles, and all the generals, you know, bits and bobs. And then we moved over to the other side, to the Jersey side, to load ammunition then. And all the bottom of all the holes, they loaded 500-pound bombs down on top of all the bilges. The 500-pound bombs were put in there. And as they come up the trunking, up the hatches, all that was filled up with cases of 4-inch shells, dynamite, TNT, cordite, and gelignite. And they did say that about 3,000 tons of ammunition went in. This was a berth somewhere outside of the town, well away from Jersey. And they loaded all this ammunition, then they put the hatches on. And they put aircraft in crates on deck, and all the spare spaces they filled up with. They must have been about 50-gallon drums, I should think. They're bigger than a 45. Might have been 50 or 60-gallon drums. Tetraethyl lead, you know, to put in petrol. This is the stuff they're taking out of the petrol now. That's to complete the loading. And then we moved down the river and waited then for one night. We just slipped and went.
And this ship was called?
Empire Pintail.
And it was HMS?
Yeah.
How did it come to be HMS?
Well, this is how it came to be. When, just before, I think it had been in HMS for about 12 months. Well, perhaps less than 12 months. When we joined it, they'd already been to the Middle East. And when the Japanese came in the war, they're in the Middle East, and they used the ship for taking Australians back to Australia, because with the Japanese in the war, they wanted reinforcements in Australia because of the Japanese threat. They'd been down to Australia and taken Japanese. But originally, the Americans had loaned, I'm not sure, it's only hearsay, that they'd loaned six, but they certainly loaned more than one. I found out since at least two anyway, I verified two, that they loaned to the British before they came in the war. They were C-3s, and they could, capable of a speed of 70, they cruised at 17 knots. And they're fast, you see. So they were built with the idea that if the Americans came in the war, they'd use them for fast transport. They loaned them to the British government on condition that if the Americans came in the war, they were to be returned immediately to the Americans. Well, by the time it was, as I say, June, July, they were in New York when I joined it. They came back to the States with the idea of turning it back over to the Americans, you know, handing it back over. But in the event, they extended the lease of it to do this one last voyage, this 4 months voyage. Because the Eighth Army was, you know, they were pretty desperate at the time. It was just about the time they were driven back to Alexandria almost. You remember? You'd know that. And we were going to Port Sudan, half the cargo, or roughly half, was due for Port Sudan, and the other half was Port Tufik. So we went down to another provision was that they weren't to use merchant navy crews; they had to use navy crews. So what they got around that by using RNVR and RNR officers. And T-124X, I think they were called, ratings.
What were they?
They were merchant navy chaps who were volunteers for the navy. They got Merchant Navy pay, Navy uniforms, Navy discipline, but Merchant Navy pay. And they were, the idea was they manned these AMCs, you know, our merchant cruisers, because they'd be familiar with the outlay of a merchant ship. They'd be more use than, say, an ordinary naval raid on a merchant ship, especially down below in the engine room. They're more, you know, more at home. They were Tier 1, 2, 4. The Merchant Navy pay with Navy discipline. They had the uniform and all the usual, the tot, you know, all the usual Navy. But and that's how they overcame it. So we were gunners. We were sort of, you know, it was a bit of an odd arrangement, really. But it was run the same as the merchant ship in every respect, regards cargo and loaded and everything else. Because most of the officers were ex-Merchant Navy, you see. They were either R in R or R in VR. Well, there had to be Merchant Navy experience for loading, supervise the loading, and, you know, and all that.
So this was a fast transport?
Oh, 17. They used to say it cruised about 70, 16 half, 17 knots. So it didn't need an escort. So it went on its own. But everywhere on its own, it's the fact they considered it fast enough to, you know, it would be too fast for submarines. But of course, it was a matter of luck. But it had got the speed. I think it'd do about 19 at a pinch if it was pushed.
What was the voyage like then?
So we were set off then for Cape Town. The first stop was Cape Town. We called in there for bunkers. We were a day in Cape Town. Got a few hours ashore, they let us ashore for you. But the real reason was just bunkers. And then we, if you want to get the exact dates, we started moving up then towards the Red Sea, and the news came over that they were landing on Madagascar. They occupied, if you know all about this, they occupied Madagascar. And I think up till that time, they were using the straits between Madagascar and the mainland. They were still using that. Shipping was still using.
Channel?
Yeah, the channel. That's it. Well, instead of going up the channel, we had to go round because of the hassle, you know, in Madagascar. So they had to go round Madagascar and sort of bypass the channel. Then we went up to Aden then. And then we stopped in Aden. I think everybody seemed to call in Aden. It was like crew station. Everybody seemed to have to go. I don't know what the idea was. But we didn't need bunkers or anything. But it was a big bunkering port, Aden was. I never bothered to go. It never looked attractive to me, Aden. And I never bothered to go ashore. We were there the day or so. So, and then we set off then up the Red Sea. And we were set course for, you know, further we knew, Port Sudan. I forget now the day, I don't know exactly how long it took. But we were due in Port Sudan, we were on watch on this one particular night. And we were due in Port Sudan the following morning. I was on the middle watch, the 12th of 4. And there were three of us on watch, like lookout. One on the port side, the port wing of the bridge. One on the starboard. And there was one on the forecastle. Going up the Red Sea, there's a danger of mines. See, so there was one on the forecastle looking for mines. That was his job, to look for mines. So how the hell he could see mines in the dark, I do not know. But anyway, he was supposed to be up there looking for mines. So there were two Dems gunners on watch. The other one was one of the crew on the forecastle. He was on watch. So I went up at 12 to relieve the chap off the 8 to 12. And a chap I relieved, he said, you're to keep a sharp lookout for a, we're expecting to see a light on fine on the port bow. We should have seen it before I came off, he said, but we haven't. He said, he told me. So down off he went. The officer of the watch, the new officer of the watch came on. He was actually the first officer. The Jibula One, they call him in the Navy. And he was the first officer. He came on. He was a gentleman, he was. Mr. Pocock. He was a real gent, he was. He came on, and he came over, and he said, I suppose you've been told what to look for. And I said, yes. He said, now, keep a sharp lookout. It's vital that you keep a sharp lookout. I said, all right. So anyway, on he went. It was a pitch black, dark night. No, there's no moon or nothing. So, towards 2 o'clock, it would be, I should think, and he came over and he said, well, he came over several times, but time to time, was, no sight, no, no. And I got the glasses on the horizon, because obviously you'd expect to see it on the horizon. And he came over, it must have been around about the 2-ish, and he said, what's that on the water? And there's a black, like a shadow on the water. And I said, oh, it could be these coal burners, when they discharge the ash, they used to discharge it at night. So it should float on the water for quite a time before it dispersed. And if they discharge it in daytime, a submarine came, a U-boat, it was seeped. He said, oh, well, then, you know, there's a ship not far away. You know, could give up, you know. So they'd always discharge the ash at night. And I said, it could be, you know, just ash. Oh, he said, well, it could be right. Could be. So he said, don't forget the light. I said, well, devil, you know, no way could you forget. Anyway, not many minutes after, I just happened to look down, because you're at quite a height when we were on the wing, above the wheelhouse, in the wing of the bridge. And I looked down, and I could see breakers. And I thought, well, we must be going into Port Sudan. You know, it just crosses your mind. Stupid thing. And the next thing, the ship stopped dead. There's a hell of a crunch. You know these big crushers that put the cars in? And they scrap the cars.
The big one?
When they scrap the old cars, you know, the wreck.
Yes.
They crush them up into a little square, don't they? It's like 200 of those going, crunch. And we stopped dead. We hit this reef. We'd hit a reef, and right in the fore peak, they'd put 45-gallon barrels of lubricating oil. It was all, you know, there were several of those in there. And that's what took the first impact, you know, pushed all these barrels. Anyway, everything, the ship stopped dead. But prior to that, just before it hit the reef, he realised, I don't know how, oh, the...